This week on Philosophers in Space, an anarchist changeling teaches us that we are but thinking tumors.
Philosophers in Space, 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 Space.
Season 2, The Beardening.
Season 2, Cry Harder.
Season 2, Queer Coded Dark Universe Edition.
Season 2, Lovecraftian, Cronenbergian, or Dickian Boogaloo.
I had Season 2, Bug Anus Boogaloo. I love it.
Season 2, Enter the Naked Time.
Season 2, fully solar-punked, ethically sourced pansexual space socialism. It's just the culture. We're just the culture now, is what I'm saying.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to Philosophers in Space. I am your captain, Callie Wright, joined as always by my chief ethics officer. I'm doing great today, Aaron Rabinowitz. How are you, friend?
I'm doing the happy skittery dance, too. I understand. We are full of excitement here on the ship.
Yeah, so we have a special guest that we are very excited about, a person singularly responsible for ruining my life over the last few weeks, Adrian Tchaikovsky. Welcome, friend.
Hello, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I reached out to you 10 million years ago, I think, before we both went into stasis pods to avoid the plague. And, you know, you were very friendly, very responsive. You mentioned that you loved the earlier episodes we did back on Children of Time, which was one of the first great books that we covered on the show. And so now that we're back and done with Children of Ruin, we wanted to have you on, but not torture you by doing the thing that where we make you talk about your own art, because I feel like some artists find that really, really painful. So I figured we'd talk about a piece of art that was very similar, and we could talk about the contrasts, and that would be a useful way to, for that you could deflect your British anxieties about talking about yourself onto somebody else.
Is that a real thing? Or Aaron, are you like putting someone else's putting a cultural bias on someone else, or is that a real thing that I'm just not aware of?
Adrian, would you care to answer?
I think that culturally, Americans, certainly US Americans, are much more willing to talk about themselves and big themselves up. And that is, what I found is that's a really useful skill to have. And coming from a British background where you're very much encouraged not to stand out and not to put yourself forward, unless, of course, you went to the right public school, it does kind of cripple your attempts at self-promotion.
Yeah, this is my understanding from my Australian wife, an editor of the show, that they have a similar thing over there. It's kind of, for some reason, Americans got free of this when we escaped the colonial empire or something like that. It's a huge problem for us. There's a bunch of evidence that suggests that, like, this is a big issue with our weird toxic meritocracy. But anyway, all of that aside, we'll come back to that in the philosophy, actually. That'll tie back in later.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Callie, do you want to introduce our, what ridiculousness are we on about today?
Yeah, so we're talking about The Things, which, you know, in contrast to having to read two entire books to do a few episodes of the show, it's a short story available just in an online magazine that you can go there. I'm sure there will be a link in the show notes. That it's great. It's similar vibes in, you know, distributed cognition and an entity that is not only confused by humanity, but in a lot of ways disgusted by us, which is always a fun perspective for me, because I love, yeah, I enjoy when things are confused by humanity, because I think it just makes sense. I am also often confused by humanity, but it is interesting to have an entity just go on and on and on about the ways that humanity doesn't make any sense and is often actually like kind of gross. And there's like there's a very, very good explanation of this in the story.
Yeah. And Adrian, you had said you'd never read this one before. Is that right?
Not until shortly before this recording. Yeah.
Which is super cool to me, because when I read Children of Ruin, I was like, whoa, this is very reminiscent of like The Things by Peter Watts. And we had done Blindsight way back when, and that was alongside Children of Time, the two books that I had never read before this show and got obsessed with and recommend to everybody now. And, you know, I think Watts, you've talked about Watts, I think, is on other places as well as being someone who like is also working in this, you know, philosophy of mind kind of conceptual space. So I really enjoy that he wrote this story, but I also enjoy that the two of you came up with very interesting and different takes on a very similar monster.
Thank you.
And so interestingly about this story, I literally did not catch on to until we had actually hit the record button that this is the other side of the movie, the thing. Because I, as a terrible sci-fi fan, I saw that movie when I was a kid. I mean, I was born in 1984, so 2 years after the movie came out. So it was you know, well known as a thing long after I was born. But for some reason, you know, I watched it when I was a kid and just didn't come back to it. And I'm reading the story, and then I heard you say that, Aaron. I was like, oh my god, wait a minute, I totally missed this. So welcome to the party, Callie. Here I'm here. I'm right here with everyone. So.
And you've seen, Adrian, have you seen the movie?
Yes, it's my favorite Carpenter movie.
Great, great. Okay. I would argue it is the best science fiction movie maybe of all time and the best horror movie of all time, I think. I really, in terms of shot-for-shot flawlessness, I don't know that there's anything that quite stands up. But, you know, people can disagree on that.
Wonderful. So I think that's the housekeeping out of the way. Still doing the Patreon drive. So that's a thing. Mm-hmm. We've got Space Puppy Hangouts coming pretty soon. So get stoked for that. And with that, Aaron, let's go ahead and plot me.
Yeah, it was a bunch of complex characters thrown into heavily serialized battles, which always ended in mind-blowing twists and made me question the basic tenets of my reality.
Are we going to let Adrian sit in the captain's chair to do the analysis?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So... as the guest on the show, I am temporarily giving up my captain's chair to our new friend Adrian. So let's go through the things. Where do we begin?
Well, all right. So the big question: am I spoiling the crap out of this?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Okay. That's it. So I mean, first and foremost, it is indeed a very, very fond homage to specifically the Carpenter, the Thing. Mm-hmm. As told from the Thing's point of view. And I don't know how many times... this is by Peter Watts, who is a magnificent science fiction writer. His best-known work is Blindsight, which is a truly visionary piece of quite mind-bending science fiction. But he's written a lot of other stuff. And he's obviously a great... I assume he must be an enormous fan of this film, and I assume he probably sat down and watched it about 5 times straight, because it's... one of the things this does is it has to tell the story of the film from the point of view of the monster, taking into account a lot of things that mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily make sense from the point of view he wants to tell it from. And he does it absolutely superbly. And he kind of ticks it. Yeah, I didn't sit down and rewatch the film along with the story, but it feels like he's gone through and ticked every little box and incident to make sure there are no contradictions and flaws right. or unanswered questions. So it feels like a real labor of love. But what it is it is the events of the film and what happens next from the point of view of a creature which has no sort of single identity. It is, its normal state is that it is constantly fluid, it adapts, and that makes perfect sense to it. And it does not get people. It has, in a very scientific way, it comes up with a variety of different theories to explain why there are all of these separate units, which are very fenced off from each other and don't change in any way. They're set in these rather inefficient physical forms. And when it basically gives them the enormous gift and favor of let me merge with you and we can share all of our accumulated shapes and forms and knowledge, they react really badly. And it's quite annoyed and a little rather put out of this.
Yeah, not only delightfully confused by, but absolutely horrified by individuality. The fact that it continually uses the word biomass to refer to people, which is brilliant.
Which is fine. You know, they are raw materials. They're not. Yep. It doesn't really have the idea of an individual. Mm-hmm. And it wants to be them, and it feels that them being it is a great thing because it has mm-hmm. so much to teach them, and they should have so much to teach it. And then it kind of, as the story goes on, we see its train of thought. You know, it thinks, are these some weird kind of experiment that's been made? Are they starved of biomass so that they can't adapt properly because of this very harsh, low energy environment it's in? Because obviously it's all set in the Antarctic. And what's this enormous lump doing at the top of this, their bodies that doesn't seem to be have any obvious function? Because one of the other things with the thing, and we're going to say thing in a variety of senses in this podcast, and it's going to get very confusing. One of the other things about the thing is that each individual bit of the thing is the thing. And right. it reacts, and it has its own kind of sentience. So what's reasonably says, okay, so its intellect is spread throughout the entire substance of it. So when it finally cottons on to the fact that this lump in our skulls is where the thinking goes on, and that's this, in, not just that we are prisoners of our shape, but we're kind of being piloted by what it describes as a tumour, insisted within the body, even, so that the body itself is just this kind of prison for this lump. It's an utterly horrific... It is as horrified by us and by this as the human characters in the film are horrified by the thing.
Yeah, I love I love that moment. It's probably one of my favorite moments in the story, is how it's, because it's describing sort of slowly making its way through the body, and everywhere it goes, it can't find intelligence. It's just finding dead meat, and it's confused, and then it like traces its way up the central nervous system and finds this thing it calls this giant tumor. And yeah, it's revolted by it. Like, it describes itself as being like thoroughly disgusted. It reminds me a lot, actually, of another short story called They're Made of Meat, which is a story about two aliens talking to each other and trying to understand how human beings are really actually just thinking meat.
I've either heard of that or I've read it.
It's a fun one. There's a great short film version of it as well. So yeah,
one of the other things, so that although that's also a key plot revelation, it also allows Watts to explain a lot of what goes on in the film, because what the setup he has is, when although the thing has kind of infiltrated bodies and is able to take them over, it finds that when it's not actively moving them, they just walk about and talk and do their own thing, because, of course, it's not infiltrated the brain. And the brain doesn't know. So all of those people who are the thing in the film don't know they are the thing, which is not a way I'd ever looked at it when looking at the film. Because you kind of, in the film, the implication is, oh, it's very cunning and it's able to mimic people perfectly in that kind of D&D doppelganger sort of way. But actually, the idea that they are, they only know themselves as themselves until the breakpoint comes and the thing needs to kind of erupt out of them or whatever, makes so much sense. And is a much more interesting way of actually, I need to rewatch the film now with that in mind, and just think of it in that way.
And the implication that I take from it is that it's similar, actually, in some ways, to the way the creature from Nod interacts with the octopi versus other entities, where it's like, you know, when it gets into the humans, it sort of slowly takes them over once it figures out their weird chemical nature and stuff. But, like, the octopi are so distributed that it just, like, they kill each other, they kill themselves trying to, like, pull it out of themselves. You know, these entities, you know, you get the impression that the thing is confused that it's sitting inside of a creature and the creature isn't reacting. Like, the creature isn't noticing that it's there.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, the word used in the story quite often is communion. It's looking for communion with the entity that it's infiltrating, because that's just how it has historically interacted with things. And the impression is, in the universe, that is kind of the normal state. It's mentions many planets it's been to, and many things it's learned, and many things it's had communion with, and that Earth life is obviously a peculiar aberration, in that we are separated off into all of these little separate cells.
And I think communion is such a brilliant word, because I feel like even those of us who aren't religious, it's like so in the culture that the word communion is associated with like a religious or spiritual practice, that's something deeper than just like sharing an experience. And the fact that it not only uses that word to describe that relationship, but it also makes it really, really good when the thing is describing how humans don't experience communion, and like what a viscerally terrible, like, hypothetical that, because obviously this creature doesn't super understand what it's like to live that way. But it makes it a really interesting way for this creature to experience its disgust that that's a thing that we don't experience.
Oh, I think it's also very interesting.
And that's,
oh, go ahead.
And that then leads us to, so the final beat of the story is, so at the end, when you've got a, you know, you have people, the two people left, and they are, you know, they are effectively both the thing whilst also being themselves. and you have it planning, well, what is it going to do? And they said, well, I could basically just wait for them all to go extinct, basically bury down in the ice, come back later when maybe things are better. But that would be terribly uncharitable of me, because here are this entire world full of these poor, poor creatures that are just lonely and separate from one another. And it's effectively my moral duty to introduce them to a more efficient way of being. And so with this great kind of philanthropy of heart, it sets off with the intention of just becoming the entire world.
Yeah, and we should cite the language specifically, because I think it's some of the darkest language I've ever read. At the end of the story, the last two lines are, these poor savage things will never embrace salvation. I will have to rape it into them.
Yeah.
Which is so dark.
It is. And if there's one thing that I like wish was maybe not in the story, is that, because I feel like that's just like unnecessarily. But especially because the creature doesn't seem to understand what that word means when it's.
Oh, like, that's why I like it
earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. Purely because I have certainly known people who, from their own experience, just have a very powerful negative response to that for reasons I'm sure you can imagine, and I feel it's not it as a. Just purely as a word to throw it about in a context that's not very specifically necessary is maybe a little.
Oh, that's interesting. I have a different reaction. I mean, I totally understand the, like, this should have a trigger warning kind of for sexual assault sort of thing. I like the way that the creature uses our language over the course of the story to describe itself in various ways that feel half-formed. And it's all of the religious language. Okay. So it's not just, you know, it uses communion, it uses the word soul, it calls itself a missionary, it says salvation, and it has this line about rape. And I think those things are all connected. I think this is actually an important, like, gestalt that I want to talk about within this story. Yeah. But I agree with you that, like, it is very punch, you know, very strong in that kind of way, and could be, in theory, sort of excessive if it wasn't tied in, I think, philosophically in those kinds of ways.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it that way, but the thought that I had immediately the first time I finished it, and I listened through this story like 3 or 4 times, the first thing I thought was like, okay, like just a couple of minutes ago, one of the humans uses the word rape to describe what the creature is doing, and the creature is confused by that. The creature doesn't know what that means, aside from to say that it detected that there was some violence associated with that word. And then all of a sudden, by the end of the story, it feels very comfortable deploying that as a way to like emphasize the violence that it's committing, or the violence that it's planning to commit.
And I mean, on that basis, unless it's simply, it is simply borrowing the word that it has had used about
it,
and taking that as, well, this is effective, this is the correct verb for what I need, what I'm going to do, because that's what I've heard from my hosts.
The implication would be it wouldn't understand the word because it's never experienced consent violations before, because when everything's in communion, that wouldn't
I suppose
be
consent
thing.
Is a major theme, isn't it? Because the the idea, it obviously, you know, it doesn't, on the basis that it considers what it's doing to be just an objective good, the idea that something would not consent to it if it understood what was going on does not occur.
So we need an empathy virus, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, like, this is sort of, you know, edging us towards the philosophy that I wanted to talk about with this, which is the kind of contrast between different approaches to uplifting, let's say, and how some of them are more maybe sort of colonial or not. Though I think it's also just worth noting before we head over to the subtext space that, you know, one thing that's really cool about this story, the original version, the original movie, The Thing, well, I mean, The Thing is based on a short story, which they do actually reference in this. The face tentacles thing is a reference actually to the original short story, What's Out There, I think is what it's called, or something like that.
And to just build that context, the very beginning of the story, The Thing is describing it, like, frantically running away from this crash and, like, in a flurry of tentacles and that sort of thing. So that's, like, the picture that it's painting.
Right, and the communion, when it describes communion at one point, it says the face tentacles come out, which is from the original. But you know, the Carpenter version is all about like fear and confusion and uncertainty because you can't see anything from the thing's perspective. So like this story in a sense could fall really flat because it takes away that possibility of confusion, right? Because we know what, which thing is the thing, right? Well, you know, like the great game of the thing is debating at the end who's actually the thing versus who isn't. And this sort of answers that question very, very, very specifically. But I like that it replaces it with a different kind of confusion, which is the aliens' confusion about why all of this is happening.
I mean, it's also two different takes on being alone. Because the Carpenter version, you get to the point nobody knows who is who and who is what, and so everyone is very alone. And that is very much the theme of this story, but from a very different point of view. It's how terrible it is to be cut off. And if you had gone to one of the characters in the film and said, right, I will give you the ability to know the thoughts of the people around you. Mm-hmm. What amazing gift that would have been. Except, of course, in this case, by doing that, you're also kind of becoming the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is similar to some of the stuff we talked about in parts like 2 and 3 of Children of Ruin, this kind of like, you don't want to be two together, but you don't want to be two separate. So how do you, you know, and like either both of those things can be sort of taken advantage of in various kinds of ways.
Yeah, I was I like 60% like, towards inviting the creature of Nod to just come on in. I was like 60% of the way there. This, yeah.
I also really like the way that it uses the phrase "the world," which it reminded me in some ways of the creature from Nod, where it seemed to sort of refer to both the actual world, but also people as the world, you know.
And presumably, on the planets where it has evolved and the other planets has met, there is no division between, there is no individuality. So the world is also the living community of the world.
Well, so that's what I was wondering was, is it calling other humans the world because it sees them as not part of communion and its language is basically like beings in communion versus entities outside of communion, which includes these weird tumor creatures, you know what I mean? Would it be like?
Yes, well, I don't think it has. My impression from the story was that it's not really expressing the concept of life that isn't sort of part of it, that isn't part of its system. So that either you're part of it, and therefore, you know, it says I am being this person, I'm being that person, I'm being this, and these are all sort of units that it has that are connected within its system. Everything outside that is the world, and whether it's the world as in this individual moving part of it or the world as in the world as a whole, I think it there is no real difference to it because they're just things that are outside itself. They're effectively inorganic until they're part of it.
Yeah, and while you mention it, I'm curious what y'all think. Do you feel like What does it mean that it uses the word I versus we, right? It was something I was thinking about because when you wrote The Creature from Nod, it's always we are doing, we are they kind of stuff. And here it's still an I. How does that impact you in terms of reading the story?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because at one point the thing does actually remark on they. What an insane word! What an insane word to apply to a community of things, because the idea of the other in terms of like things that are capable of thinking and feeling is just so viscerally weird and foreign to this creature. And that's, to me, I don't know that specific thing communicates anything to me aside from that, like, conceptually this thing does not yet understand even the concept of individuality, and so I don't know that that wording specifically makes a difference to me or not.
Yeah, I think at the kind of the very base cognitive level, the Nodan organism works in a slightly different way and has a slightly different concept of itself. And it certainly has it doesn't necessarily recognize others as individuals, but it recognizes effectively an environment distinction, and also that it is plural, and then it can split, and that the split parts of it will then have different experiences that can be kind of recombined later on. So it's a constantly shifting plurality, but it is definitely a plurality.
I also think there's something interesting to the fact that it has, and this is true, I guess, of The Creature from Nod as well, a kind of sense of its own identity over time. It talks about, and like a sense of like conviction. It says that, like, you know, it still believes that its own survival is meaningful. So it's, you know, I wonder if you could really be a kind of entity that would simultaneously have that sense of yourself and why you're meaningful, but not be able to, you know, comprehend why another entity would resist sort of being absorbed in this way.
Well, I mean, I guess with the thing as seen in this story, the assumption I'm working on is that its sense of self can't really be a distinct individuality in the same way that ours is, but mm-hmm. it is adaptable in the same way that the physical is adaptable. It has a memory, which is, you know, because that's gone into in some detail, the fact that when it is damaged when it is damaged or loses parts of itself, then it's losing parts of its memory, and its ability to recall all of this enormous amount of experience it's had has fallen away. But mm-hmm. I don't think you would necessarily have a sense of yourself as a unique individual if you came from a culture where there was only you, because you have nothing to compare it to. It's only when you run into an Earth-style system, as it is in the story, that it would have to even start to consider the idea of, well, what if you've got me and then there's another me and we don't have this connection?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is basically, it's something it's genuinely wrestling with quite at a very existential level throughout a lot of the story.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting to me to think about, like, what is it like where this creature comes from, right? Like, is it, just because this is how my brain works, is it like the Great Link for the Changelings in Star Trek, where it's like most of them are like together in communion and then every once in a while a drop like goes off and like does its own thing, but the idea is always that it comes back to become a part of the greater whole? Because like this creature obviously is these individual peoples at once, and it's like, is that connection just mediated by distance? Because it can be these different people at the same time, even if they're not necessarily physically connected to one another. Mm-hmm. But this creature, I mean, I guess I don't know this for sure, but I would assume that there is a different origin point where there are maybe more of this creature, and I don't know if it's like the same individual slightly separated from the whole, or is it, are there individuals in a different way than we might understand it? And that, like, maybe that's diving more into philosophy, but I'm just very interested in how that psychology works.
Yeah, I mean, it's not expressly said. The impression I came away with was certainly that, you know, on the planet that this thing evolved on. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one of the things to note is, just like in the film, it's not just a blob. It has a technology. They build spaceships to go. Yeah, you know, they don't just kind of spit themselves out organically. They actually build stuff. So they obviously have a technological society. Or I suppose it's not a they. It has a technological society. I would assume that it's kind of one of those ego the living planet sort of deals, that the planet is an individual. The whole biosphere of the planet is an individual thing, which I don't see why that should not be a viable evolutionary path, to be honest. I mean, what alternate non-Darwinian evolution is something I've been looking at for projects of my own over the last couple of years. And you know, you can break away from this, the whole survival of the fittest evolutionary race, and this would certainly be one model for it. Is just like your entire, you know, rather, you know, quite beyond anything sort of Gaia hypothesis sort of thing, your entire biosphere is an individual, and at some point it obviously gets curious about, well, what's all that stuff out there, where are these radio signals coming from? Because I'm a super intelligent alien, I will build a spaceship and I'll put some of me in a spaceship, and it will then be separated from me by distance or however it works, and go off and have a look, and presumably at some point come back.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because at the beginning it does talk about being like at a crash of some kind. Because I was thinking about if there were maybe like other quote unquote individuals, such that word means anything, like on this ship, that maybe died in the process or something, and then it would be like a traumatic experience to be separated from that. But if they're like on a spaceship and actively exploring, I guess that would make more sense that would like feel somewhat normal.
It definitely has like changelings cut off from the kind of collective kind of vibe. Right. But you know, I think that, I guess the like pushback that comes to mind for me when you hear these kind of things, or like with the creature from Nod, where, you know, every cell contains all the information. There's a kind of like division of labor principle that it seems like is fairly common both in society but also in the natural world, where entities, as they get more complex, if they're going to have, you know, multi-process systems, they're going to have division of labor between entities, and you often get like specialization into those things. And like on a bodily level, you know, our cells specialize in these different kinds of ways. So like the, you know, and this gets a little towards the philosophy, like some of the pushback to some of what the thing says would be that like hierarchies are good because you can get more done than if everybody's trying to do all of the activities or something like that. And I sort of wonder if there's a similar conservation principle in biology.
All right, let's talk about ants' nests then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ants' nests don't have a hierarchy. You know, the queen does not tell ants what to do. Ants do mm-hmm. what they do, which is frequently, you know, fantastically complex and involves considerable division of labor entirely through kind of emergent behavior. Mm. It happens out, it arises out of the complex interaction of the whole. The idea of an organism, if it is sufficiently malleable as the creature in the thing, where it can form effectively temporary tools and organs and parts to perform functions, there's no reason why that shouldn't be able to organize itself emergently rather than having a hierarchical structure.
Yeah, I guess it's not so much that like necessarily that there needs to be a hierarchy as that there needs to be division of labor of some sort.
But you can get, you think your division of labor, I mean, the ant that does a thing one day doesn't need to be doing the same thing the next day. Your division of labor doesn't necessarily require permanently specialized parts if your biology allows you to temporarily specialize underneath at need. And one of the early points in the story is it's about adaptability, and it is one of the things that's most horrified about with Earth life and humans is how non-adaptable they are.
Right. And like, yeah. You know, I guess the question is, would there be a like, this reminds me sort of like Grey Goo theory, sort of like the nanobot swarms. You know, why can't we just make a nanobot swarm that can turn into whatever structure we want it to? But it turns out actually that like, that's harder to do than like creating, you know, leg joints and arm joints. And like, in that kind of sense, having specialized structure works better than maximal flexibility. Like, maximal flexibility comes at a kind of cost, potentially. I'm not saying it does. I'm just sort of like, that might be the pushback.
I guess the thing in there is, yes, a leg joint, a permanent leg joint, is absolutely more efficient than having to sort of botch job together a leg joint every time you need it, unless you don't always walk. You know, if you spend your life, mm-hmm. if you end up in the sea, then actually those great big heavy walking legs of yours are not necessarily a very good way of getting about. Mm-hmm. So if you have a creature that is, you know, again, it's adaptability. Humans are very good for the range of tasks that humans are good at and rubbish at flying.
We should also, it seems like, distinguish between physical adaptability and the sort of distributed cognition that we're seeing in these entities. Because you could have a shape changer like Odo, who's still just a tumor in a solid form. But like, that's different from every cell is fully, you know, ensouled, right? Or conscious, or however, you know, like this creature is saying that like there's a soul everywhere. It's implying that like, if it goes to the cells in my kneecap, it can have a conversation with them the same way than if it goes to the cells in my brain. I don't know that you necessarily would need that for maximal flexibility. Or I wonder what sort of cost would come at kind of having that capacity. Or is it, you know, like, is the thing just wrong in that, like, maybe there is that kind of thing in our cells, but it's in the DNA and it just can't interface with it properly or something like that?
I feel like we've begun to grok it already, Aaron.
Yeah, shall we head into the grok it zone? We're doing psychology and biology.
We are.
It's not philosophy. It's totally separate.
That's fair.
No, it's a short story. We got through it. I think it was short. Let's talk about philosophy, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's grog it.
It's a story device. Literally. A literal literary device, quite literally, metaphorically containing us.
Okay, so there's a couple of things here that I think are really interesting. This adaptation being provocation and an incitement to violence is a kind of great
line.
Yeah. Oh. And it's where you're supposed to feel, I think, the most like the creature is the good guy. And I've always, when I watched the original, I'm not always, but like for a long time when I've watched the original The Thing, my one complaint with it was it doesn't have any women in it. And so I always like to pretend that The Thing was the woman and that it's the good guy and that it survives and that it, you know, defeats the patriarchy that's like trying yes. to prevent it from surviving.
I'm so into this.
Yeah, it's like I have a really long feminist analysis of The Thing, which we can get to in the After Dark or something. But, you know, it ties to what I want to talk about here, which is I want to talk about the idea of kind of assimilationist uplifting. Because, Adrian, you do a lot of stuff with uplifting. Mm-hmm. And I think often when you're doing it, it's a semi-benevolent kind of thing. And this entity here, to some extent, sees itself as benevolent. But it comes off as much less benevolent to me than the creature from Nod. When we talked about the creature from Nod, you know, we see it as sort of having like a kind of childlike mind almost. It's a play, you know, it's playing. It wants to go on an adventure and have fun. It doesn't realize that it's causing harm. Whereas this creature feels a little bit more like it knows that it's doing something against the creature's will, but it's fine with that because it thinks it's doing it for the right reasons.
Well, my reading of that is it's an imperialist.
Exactly.
It is absolutely, exactly. It's the British Empire tromping out there saying, well, you're going to have our religion and you're going to have our way of doing things because they're obviously better and we're doing you an enormous favor by taking all of your stuff and giving you all of our things.
Yeah, so in that sense, it's colonialism, right?
It's exactly that kind of obviously my way is better. And in this case, obviously, the difference between it and humans is so vast that it's... You know, it is possibly a little less mendacious than European colonial imperialism. Because, all right, you know, the idea that this thing would believe that obviously everything needs to be freed to have this enormous flexible adaptation because that is so much better than these little boxes you've locked yourselves in. You know, it makes a lot of logical sense from the point of view that the story expresses, but it's still, you know, it's taking a step back. And I assume this may well be the one of the points that the story is supposed to be making is it is absolutely that kind of imperialist idea that is going to completely obliterate the thing that it's found in order to bless it with the gifts of civilization, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay. Quickly, Hallie.
Okay. Can of worms. I'm just going to throw it out there. I think. Obviously, on Earth, we have no excuse to not recognize the sentience and the agency of other humans, right? I don't know that I feel comfortable ascribing the same knowledge of the other people's agency to the creature in the story as I do to the humans on Earth, right? Because I think this thing realizes that there is some capability of reasoning that we might recognize like in dogs or, you know, or like dolphins or octopuses, for example. But I think this creature really only recognizes humans on that level. And I don't know if I'm all the way there and thinking that that there is like less benevolence in that.
Oh, so I would say that's exactly like imperial colonialism in the sense that imperial colonialists tell themselves that the people who are being colonized are inferior in this kind of way and need to be uplifted in this kind of way because right. they are like dogs. And again, you're right. It sees itself as benevolent, but it's much, much more malevolent in that viewed from that angle. And I also want to highlight what I love about this story is that, yes, it gives you these colonialism vibes, but it also highlights that colonialism evolves into liberalism, progressivism, and neoliberalism. Because what it's trying to bring is multiculturalism, right? What it's trying to bring is you know, communion with a larger communist kind of whole, essentially, a globalism, you know, of the mind in this sense. And the individuals are the kind of cultural stand-ins for, you know, like communities that don't want to be absorbed. And that's why I wanted to call it assimilationist uplifting in particular. Mm-hmm. It's assimilating on a cultural level as well as sort of a literal physical kind of level. It's saying you can't be separate from this great whole anymore. And you're going to be happier and you're going to thank us for that. And you're going to be a better person because of it. But that's not really its choice to make.
Well, right. My thought, though, is that like other humans on this world have zero excuse to think that way. Like it's mm-hmm. just that they don't care or that they're terrible or that their values are messed up. Whereas I think this creature, if not good or excusable, I find it understandable that this creature doesn't have the same realization about humans, if that makes sense, because of how foreign our way of operating is to this creature, right? And so it's not that I'm necessarily being an apologist for this creature, saying that what it's doing is not such a bad thing, but I think I think it might actually have a legitimate like ignorance excuse.
Well,
yeah, it's interesting. So I'm with you, save that there are two or three very, very keenly pointed sentences to show that I think at the point at the end of the story, when it's made its decision of what it's going to do, it has also got to the point where it kind of understands. Yeah, I mean, I guess this is what comes to that final word choice, that it is going to do something mm-hmm. violent and invasive. And I mean, the sentence before that, these poor savage things will never embrace salvation, which is absolutely straight out of the colonial missionary playbook.
That's a good point.
And it effectively, it has the option to mm-hmm. not do this. Right. It's not, you know, it is not that it has got beyond the point where it is defending itself. It is no longer under threat. It has the option to go away. It expressly says that. And it decides, no, I have a moral duty to improve mm-hmm. these poor savage creatures. So
that's a
fair
point.
At that point, it has a sufficient concept of what it's dealing with that it actually has hit that level of...
It's literally quoting Kipling at this point. It's just like the white monster's burden, right? Like it's just 100% there.
That's a good point. So maybe it had that excuse at the beginning of the story, but not by the end of it.
Well, and it's an interesting question. Yeah. Like, did it, you know, it says in the story, one of the things I love about it is that it says that it's horrified that it's taken communion with these tumors.
Right.
And so you could ask a question. It's an interesting question. Was the monster always this kind of missionary, convincing itself that it's a good creature when it's really causing harm? Or did it absorb all of these human concepts and turn into this creature because of that?
Oh, that's a good thought. That's a good point.
So the real monster was inside us all along, but not in the way that it is literally inside us all along.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and one of my favorite quotes of all time, I always cite this, it's John Carpenter again talking about The Thing. He says, you know, the monster is always us. It's just us with funny hats on. And I think we're not overreading this text. I think Watts is really, really explicitly like step by step going through the colonial project here. Another example that comes to mind for me, you know, we talked about, there are really two things that this creature often references, science and religion. So it uses a bunch of religious terminology, but as you pointed out, it also uses a bunch of like scientific analysis. Maybe these things are just tumors or something, you know, like, and that is right out of colonialist playbooks, right? At the same time that we're saying these things have no souls, we're also saying evolution proves that they are defective or inferior and need to be taken care of in this kind of way. So it really does read to me like a thoroughgoing, like colonialist out on their project, you know, doing the white man's burden thing straight up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and that, you know, brings me to something that I end up having a problem with in a lot of sci-fi is the notion that, you know, any other life form would eventually get to the place that modern humans in real life as we know them are, that like that sort of colonialism, the urge to like conquer and assimilate and all of that, there's something inherent enough to that social and cultural dynamic that, you know, any life form could potentially get there or will eventually get there. And I would just I would love to explore worlds where that doesn't happen. But of course,
well,
I mean
mm-hmm. I mean, it's something I try and pull back from in the Children of sequence, certainly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and in Children of Memory, I do a lot of wrestling with the idea of what is it right to do.
Yep.
If you've got all the high-tech toys and someone is in trouble, because the moment you step in, you are going to obliterate their entire culture just purely by the fact of you, even if your intentions are genuinely the best. So what do you do? And I don't, it's a tricky question that I will quite happily say I do not give a glib answer for, because I don't think there's a glib answer for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and this, one of the reasons I want to talk about the assimilationist stuff is because in doing the education PhD, there's a lot of things going on in pedagogy world right now around critical race theory, obviously, but it's, you know, in the terminology in education is often culturally relevant pedagogy, which is put in direct contrast with assimilationist pedagogy. And the idea is, you know, colonialism wasn't literally just, you know, forcing people to collect rubber at gunpoint. It was also teaching, you know, taking children away and teaching them at, you know, residential schools where they learn to be good Christians and stuff like that. And that's sort of the essence of the assimilationist education model, and was always done for these exact same reasons of, like, this will be better for the children, right? Their original culture is backwards and deficit. Their new culture will be, you know, full of all of the advantages that will allow them to have better quality of life. And the result was often, you know, people who felt alienated from every culture, all, you know, like their original culture, the culture they're being forced into, et cetera, et cetera. So you have this push now towards this more culturally relevant pedagogy where you're trying to, you know, take up the assets of people's communities and bring those things in and have this kind of multicultural approach. But that also has its, you know, various kinds of challenges. How do you avoid sliding towards relativism and things like that? And also, is your multiculturalism itself a culture that is getting indoctrinating people into? You know, some people don't want to be multicultural in this sense, right? You know, the next show we're going to do is going to be Discovery, and I was just rewatching parts of that, and like the problem with the Federation is that they just want to like everybody, you know. So
I mean, it's very Ian Banks in his culture novels writes a lot about that, and there is, although it's never front and center, there is always this slightly uncomfortable. Is the culture kind of doing what it absolutely expressly says it doesn't do in simply having any kind of relations with anyone else? Because they're very, very big on how you act, and they have a lot of advantages. And you kind of get the impression that there are a lot of species in the culture, but how individual are they really? How much of themselves do they have left that isn't just given over to being part of the culture?
Let me ask you all a hypothetical that relates to this. There's a classic ethics hypothetical called the coherent Caligula problem. So this is essentially, can you be an immoral person and also be rational? Like, is it rational to act immorally? If you have enough power, you're never going to be punished for your actions. There's a corollary to this that I think is a problem for liberals, which is the idea of the irrational or the rational illiberalist, right? Somebody who really genuinely wants to live in a illiberal society and believes and thinks they have good reason to do so, right? And I think we struggle to believe that such an entity can exist. And so we buy into this idea that, like, people who don't want to live in liberal societies are in some sense mentally damaged and irrational and need to be saved from themselves.
Or that they're hypocrites. Is also, I mean, it's a lot easier to think that actually, you know, that person is saying those things because it personally benefits them, but they don't really believe that it's best for everyone.
But, you know, take a thoroughgoing white supremacist, right? Someone who really, you know, like if Rawls came to them and said, but what if you're born black into a white supremacist society? They'd say, good, you know, like I still should be in a white supremacist society no matter who I am or something like that. Do you think that they're being irrational or unreasonable, or do they just have different values to enough of a degree?
I was going to say, I think it's a values thing. I really do. Because I shouldn't say that as unequivocally as I did. I think I think values has a lot to do with it. And I think this, it's values and it's the structure of society that often rewards that behavior. And so, like, I'm thinking very specifically about a lot of people that I know that, or have known that, abuse their power over other people, for example, and seem to be continuously rewarded for that behavior by the structure of the society that we live in. And I think if your values are skewed to a certain degree and you are consistently rewarded for that behavior, I think it is entirely rational to continue acting that way. If obviously horrifically immoral, there is a chain of logic there that makes sense to me. And the only thing that breaks that is shifting your values to understand more about the way that you move through the world and how it affects other people as opposed to how it reifies your own status.
I think there's, I mean, I think there are, so there are a couple of other major elements here. First of all, I don't know if it's genuinely a thing that someone would say, ah, yes, white runs society, obviously better, even if you were black, it's obviously better, because there's so much of the white supremacist doctrine that is based on a fear of what if they do it to us. Mm-hmm. There's very little thing. Oh, obviously, it's much, much better for all of them to live under our kind of power. It's far more, well, look, if we don't stamp them down, then they will outpopulate us or out this us or out that us. And that suggests to me that they are not working from that logical point of view of, oh, yes, obviously, it's better for everyone to work in this society, because it is far more adversarial than that. The other thing is that cognitive dissonance does a colossal amount of work. Mm-hmm. So that if you are in a society that has benefited you and someone calls you out on it, it's a lot easier to find a line of argument. And there is always a line of argument as to why this is nonetheless the best of all possible worlds than it is to change the way that you think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this brings me, I mean, like, I think this question lands us on a really hard problem in meta-ethics, which is basically, are there objective values? Or are there objective claims that could be made about values? Specifically, can we claim that certain things are better or worse than other things? So, for example, is a life spent getting to freely choose what you want to do better than a life spent having someone choose for you because of your gender? I think, you know, despite being skeptical, you know, being iffy about the word objective, I think a lot of liberals implicitly believe that living in that kind of world would be a better world, and people in that would be objectively better off, and that, like, they would be more likely to flourish than if they lived in the other kind of system. Whereas conservatives genuinely believe, you know, the freewheeling, pick your own, you know, choose your own adventure story of liberalism is bad for people compared to a society that helps you understand your role based on your gender and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that difference comes down to values too, right? Because it's not universally, of course, but a lot of conservative thinking is undergirded by like conservative theology, conservative religious belief that prioritizes what comes after this over what happens now. And so it's, you know, you can, for example, like you can point to like the drag bans that are happening in the US, or the like making it illegal to literally be who I am as a trans person in the country, which is a very fun process that we're going through at the moment. Very excited about it. I can argue all I want to a politician who's doing this because of their values, saying that these things are hurtful to me, they're hurtful to other people, they're hurtful especially to children who don't necessarily understand the cultural context that this is all happening in, and all they know is that like people are being awful to them and making it harder for them to live their lives. The people who I'm saying this to, I think are capable of understanding and believing that, but it's less important to them because they're more worried about this person's immortal soul, or you know, what's going to happen to them in the afterlife, you know. So it so often comes down to a difference of values for me. That's where I always come back to.
I tend to be cynical enough to think that most of the time when this sort of thing is going on, a worry about someone's actual immortal soul is not really what's behind either the people at the top who are kind of inciting this, or the people at the bottom who are, you know, turning up in this case with automatic weapons to actually enact it.
Yeah.
I think there are a number of complex sort of power dynamic issues going on in this setup, and things like religious values are very much more of a fig leaf. But that's me, because I'm not a religious person. And maybe it's simply that the idea of, you know, being a genuine, devout, God-fearing Christian Spanish Inquisition member who genuinely believes that I need to torture these people to death so that they confess because it's better that way so that they can go to heaven. I mean, it is so much easier for me to accept, to find far more effectively material and cynical motivations for things like that than to think, actually, yes, this person genuinely believes that, and in their eyes they are doing an actual good by lighting someone on fire.
I think it's true for extreme acts of violence. I think the most of the people who think that it's bad for trans individuals to get gender-affirming care as young people probably just genuinely think that, like, the science proves that in some way. Like, I don't, you know, or believe the soul stuff or something like that. But I think, like, whatever their real intentions, I think this gets to a point of we are debating what is objectively better and worse for children. And I think the child example is really important because it brings us back to this issue of consent, right? We don't think that it's okay, for example, to just let a child kill them, you know, like end their lives if they are going through a temporary period of depression. We could have a debate about chronic depression. That's a whole separate conversation. But like, right. you know, someone breaks up with you, you're depressed. No one's going to let you off yourself at that point because we think objectively you're going to be happier. You're going to have a better life of flourishing if you don't die at that particular moment. Similarly, I think the people who are arguing for gender affirming care for children are, you know, for people who are under the age of consent, let's say, is because we think that it will be really valuable and helpful for them and improve their quality of life in ways that are objectively morally worth the trade-off in this kind of way. And that's why we're willing to go to the mat and have a law for this kind of thing or something like that. And this, you know, like to tie it back to the story, it's sort of a question of like, should you, you know, if you found out that like a child could get communion in the way that this creature does, but it can only do it by the age of like 12 or 13, should you as a parent, you know, be able to like consent on behalf of your child for it to have communion if that means being part of this massive consciousness collective? So instead of a cultural kind of assimilation, it's an individual and they're being assimilated before they might have full understanding of what that could necessarily mean. In those kind of situations, I think the reason we think it's okay to violate autonomy or personal bodily integrity is because of objective moral truths, like you should reduce suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then if we accept that, the question is, how can we say that the creature is wrong here is the problem? Because if the creature really could objectively improve the quality of life of every human being on the planet by assimilating them in this way, is it doing something good? Does it still need to try to persuade us?
I mean, from our perspective, of course, it isn't going to improve the life of every single individual human being because there won't be any individual human beings at that point.
Right.
But from its point of view, that is actually not a bad thing. That is genuine. That is a thing that it certainly, looking at the earlier stages of the story before it started to kind of descend into that particular mode of language, that is something that it genuinely does feel is to be wished and is you know, it talks about loneliness and it talks about that sort of isolation. And again, you know, isolation is a big theme of the original movie. And so, yeah, it could quite possibly stand up and give you a very cogent reason as to why everyone being it is surely to be preferred.
And maybe you could point out, look, actually, I'm not killing anybody. I'm giving everybody immortality, right? Because, if it's like the creature from Nod, all of the people that it, you know, has communion with, their memories themselves in this sense are part of it now and are carried on forever and eternity in this kind of way as long as the species survives. So like you get, you know, similar to that kind of conversations in Children of Memory where it's like, you know, you could have potentially lots of versions of you out, you know, out across the universe, exploring, experiencing things in this kind of way. That would be really a great thing for you and pleasurable. And it also, like, the creature itself has, like I said, an awareness of, you know, valuing persistence of my memories and my identity over time. So maybe it would say, well, look, I know that you value that. I'm not going to take it away. I'm just going to add to it, right? I'm just putting more on top. I'm not taking anything away here. It's like the birdcage. I don't know if that works or not, but, you know, that's, you're still sort of destroying the person's prior existence in one sense, but this gets into a, like a persistence of the self question. If I go out into the world and meet a bunch of different cultures and learn a bunch of different things, I'm still myself. if this thing's just doing that via rapid upload process, is that different?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, what we do get is when it talks about its prior experiences on other worlds, so worlds that are not its world, but are not our world. And the thing it's mostly taken away from those are adaptations and shapes. Mm-hmm. So we don't get a sense that it has been individuals, or even that it has been individuals as big as world-sized consciousness. We don't get the sense that, yes, when I was on this world, that had this particular personality, and when I was on that world, it had a different personality. Mm-hmm. It's all the one thing. So it is absolutely this steamrollering of everything into this kind of... It is a psychological or even philosophical grey goop.
What do you think
sort
about,
of scenario?
And what do you think about the claim? The creature claims that this is the first world where it's ever experienced entities that were not like itself in this kind of fluid communion sense. It sort of argues almost that like we're the freaks, right? That everybody else is not like this, and for some reason we're super strange. Is that though like just an unreliable narrator?
I wondered about this because initially I thought, that's a really interesting idea that our kind of sort of separate entity evolution on Earth is the exception, this weird outlier. And then because you get towards the end and you see it effectively starting to weasel in its own logic and starting to kind of mince words somewhat about what it's going to be doing and why, or at least you can interpret it that way, you start to wonder, were those worlds actually like it originally, mm-hmm. or were they only like that at the end? And it's kind of had some sort of editing process. But I would normally look for a little more of a pointer towards that kind of unreliable narratorship. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite sure it's there in the story, so I don't know.
Yeah,
I think it's a potential reading, but you have to start building scaffolding around it a bit.
Yeah, it makes me think about how, and this is a thing that I hear across a lot of different types of people, but I would feel comfortable saying that you hear it more often in conservative political circles, the idea that you're justifying your own belief by saying that other people think and feel the same way, right? Like a lot of people are saying, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that it might be that sort of justification of its own behavior. And so it might be kind of doing a deliberate misreading of the other life it has encountered to justify its own motivations at absorbing.
Yeah, although it's just the extreme degree of shock and horror it has, which is pretty much like a 50% of the entire story, really, is exploring that. Does maybe suggest maybe that is an honest assessment, and we generally are the freaks for being separate.
Another way you could sort of justify it from the text would be maybe it talks about how it's lost parts of itself, it's lost pieces of its memory. It may be that it lost the parts where it assimilated things that didn't want to be assimilated. Right, especially
yes,
and those would be the members you want to lose first.
Conveniently so.
right. What goes first?
It does. I mean, it does. It is saying that it has been pared down to something much, much smaller than it was. So I think that given that loss of memories is pointed up, I think at least twice in the text. I think that's certainly a valid.
It's kind of a memento monster a little bit there. So like the concern I think this raises then is you have a weird kind of catch-22 problem where there's really no such thing as consensual uplifting. There's only assimilationist uplifting because any entity... So like, you know, maybe if you had a human being, right, could you get it to consent to uplifting? Would it be able to understand the concept enough and what it was going to become enough to like make that an actual kind of informed consent? But you certainly would have trouble with things like your friends that you so desperately want to uplift for purely platonic reasons, let's say.
I mean, Flowers for Algernon is consensual uplifting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously that goes dreadfully wrong, but it's not implicit in the concept that it has to.
Well, is that consensual uplifting? Because
no, it's done to him, isn't it? Sorry,
he's severely disabled at the beginning of that story,
It is not. I'm misremembering that entirely.
Well, the thing that makes me think of is medical ethics, right? Is informed consent possible? Like, can a doctor sufficiently explain a medical thing to you such that you can actually have informed consent? I think that's the corollary that it makes me think of.
Yeah,
I mean, and I'm sure that there must be plenty of sci-fi where this has been done, but I think you could have an Algernon style situation where someone sees, okay, this is what it does to rats. I'm going to try it on me because I would quite like to be, you know, faster, mm-hmm. better, stronger, smarter, etc. And obviously transhumanism as an idea is effectively all about consensual self uplift, whether it's uplift or upload or however you want to do it. It's very much the idea that we would like to make ourselves better. So I think you can have consensual uplift if you're doing it to yourself. If you have the traditional sort of David Brin style uplift that I'm borrowing for the children books, mm-hmm. then no, because you are implicitly dealing with a thing which isn't capable of making that decision, because if it was, then you wouldn't need to uplift it.
Right, exactly. Right, you're trying to give it the power to consent.
That's the catch-22. Yeah,
it's very similar, actually, to like Benatar and folks who make arguments, antinatalism arguments. Right, you can never consent to being born, so it's wrong to have a child because you are violating their consent by bringing them into the world in this kind of way. But I think, you know, There's different parts to consent. I think bringing in the medical ethics stuff is exactly right. You know, when I talk about this with medical students, you know, the informed part of informed consent is a tricky word, right? Because, like, going back to gender affirming care, right? If it turns out that, like, gender, you know, like hormone blockers lead to sterility or have a higher risk of sterility, there's a real open debate about whether a 13-year-old child can understand the concept of you'll never be able to have your own children. And we can debate whether that's, you know, an acceptable trade-off. We can debate, you know, what amount they can understand that sort of thing. But it's not an easy question, I think.
Yeah, and it's... Well, and I guess it comes back to values again, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's, I think... You know that trade-off is a thing that possibly exists, and really all you have are your values to apply to that question.
Right, and so then it's like, am I just deciding based on my own preference for biological children, whether or not this individual should get to have biological children or not? And then that goes back to the objectivity thing, right? It's like, I will be more comfortable doing that if I can objectively say, look, the value of having children is in, you know, you could have it from an adopted child just as much as a biological child, mm-hmm. for example. Or if I think, you know, there actually is something about it being your own child in this kind of way, is there an objective fact of that matter that we can point to in order to justify our decision there?
Yeah. Well, and it's, I mean, there's lots of cultural analysis to be done around that fact too, right? Because, like, it makes sense that we have an evolutionary impulse to, like, pass our genetics down from, you know, person to person, because in theory, that's how the species survives. But I mean, also, I think a lot of the, like, we have to have biological children thing is that that's a cultural teaching, right? That's not something that's necessarily mm-hmm. inherent. And so that's, again, just to, I guess that kind of draws an even bigger circle around the, like, how do we actually decide this question?
Well, so inherent is a fun word there, right? So to me, as a virtue ethicist, this all comes back to flourishing, right? What does it mean for a human being to flourish? Mm-hmm. How do we promote flourishing? Does flourishing require having your own biological children or not? I don't think it does for everyone, but it might for some people. And we might not know if we're that kind of person until it's too late, potentially. And that's just really bad luck for some people. It's bad bad moral luck to not be able to flourish in that situation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think we can say, look, there are lots of different ways to flourish that don't all involve having biological children. But if we find that it's very difficult to flourish if you are not, you know, getting gender-affirming care, then, like, you know, you're meeting a basic need there and then figuring out what your path to flourishing is based on the effects of that, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that's really what it comes down to, right? Because the question of flourishing in that one is a hypothetical, and I don't say that to dismiss the importance of it, but it's... I don't think there is a way that you can make it more than a hypothetical, because all you can do are make educated guesses about that question. But the level of abject suffering that comes from the lack of that kind of care is not a hypothetical, right? It is very real and very present for a whole lot of people. And so for me, again, that's the values judgment that actually makes that question extraordinarily easy for me. I can understand why it might feel more complicated.
I mean, I think this is the reason these kind of when you start to try and model the world in these very in these kind of two category systems of, well, this is obviously bad or this is obviously good, and those are the only options. Anyway, it's that very everything becomes a straw man. Yeah, right. Would you rather live mm-hmm. in an incredibly repressive dictatorship, or do you want complete anarchy and everything is on fire? And those are the only options you've got. And unfortunately, this is what social discourse and political discourse especially tends to degenerate into very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that every individual case is very complicated and people are very complicated and things should be considered on their own individual merits gets lost, because that is difficult. And it's a thought, it's something that requires energy to think about, rather than just being able to take up, obviously, this is all bad, and then never have to think about it again.
As soon as you bring up the government thing, one of the like side philosophical topics that I thought was cool in this story, that in some ways relates back to this kind of these broader questions of consent, is the kind of anti-hierarchical thinking that the creature, you know, sort of conveys throughout the story, which again makes this feel very woke to me, right? Like this creature yeah. is like hitting all of the high points of culturally mm-hmm. relevant pedagogy here. It's very much a feminist. I feel very validated in believing that this creature was a feminist all along. Because, you know, it says things like centralization is vulnerability, right? And this kind of distributed, you know, non-centralized thing is very popular in a lot of thinking on the left right now, also very popular in some places on the right in the anti-globalist kind of spaces as well. But what came to mind for me actually, you know, like there's a pushback here, which is, again, division of labor is good. It's good in a government. It's good for individuals. It's good in our bodies. We don't want all of our cells doing all the same kinds of things. And actually, there's a specific story from Greece that gets picked up in Shakespeare as well. It's the story of the belly of the members. And it's essentially yes. the myth of, like, you know, what happens if the belly was to rebel against the brain or the feet, or, you know, argue with the feet or something like that. And there's supposedly a story that, like, a senator at one point convinced the plebeians of Rome to stop rioting by explaining to them that, like, look, you're the feet, and the feet are really important, and the Senate is the stomach, and it's okay that we have these different roles and different jobs. And so, you know, sometimes hierarchy obviously can be used just to justify inequality, right? But, like, the idealized version of that would be, no, it actually is valuable that, like, you're focused on this and you're focused on that, and that's okay as long as we're all getting taken care of in the end.
Well, and that's the side of that line of thinking that often doesn't get talked about, because, Adrian, to your point, there's the, you know, the hard extremes, and people seem to think there's no thing in the middle. And like, the reason that people think anarchy means chaos is it's propaganda, right? Because what anarchists will tell you is that it's not about chaos, it's about consensus, right? It's about, there is no hierarchy, but we all still have to get together and agree about the right way to do things. And of course, you know, the question becomes, if some people refuse to do that, like, what do you do about that? Obviously, that's an important question. But I think that's the ground that we don't often end up treading, is the notion that, like, we have to, like, get together and figure this stuff out. Where the question ends up becoming, do we let people do whatever the hell they want, or do we do the dictatorship? And, you know, I don't know that I have really good or thoughtful answers to that, but I think that is more the question.
I also wanted to tie in here the constant use of, like, communion, salvation, all of this stuff. This is very reminiscent to me of the kind of Gnosticism that I keep encountering recently, doing, like, the high weirdness kind of things that we look at on this show. And I just had a conversation with Eric Davies over on my other show about high weirdness. And there is this kind of constant Gnostic theme of, you know, enlightenment from the outside and being brought back into communion when you are living in this kind of enforced artificial separation from, you know, the logos or whatever or something like that. And this creature reminded me of just having that very kind of, like, Gnostic vibe of, like, I'm gonna drag all of these people into enlightenment kicking and screaming. And, like, that's, you know,
I mean, traditionally, isn't that exactly the opposite to what Gnostics generally? I thought the whole point of being Gnostic was that you had a very small group of people who were going to be enlightened and everyone else can go hang.
Well, yeah, it depends on whether you think that you're predetermined about whether you're going to be enlightened or not. How Calvinist are you about this, essentially? But, like, you know, going back to Flowers for Algernon or uplifting kind of question, you know, if you have this idea where, like, if you put the button in front of the person and explain to them, if you press this button, your IQ will go up 1 point every time you press it. And if your IQ goes up 10 points, you will find these activities easier. And if it goes up 20 points, you'll find these activities easier. Are they able to make a non-coerced choice there is my question. I'm skeptical that it could be so. And this is something that comes up in medical ethics a lot. We always assume, a lot of us, that like giving someone a choice can't harm them because all they can do is just decline the choice if they don't want it. But a lot of choices are actually coercive, and just being given the choice can actually harm you. You know, the classic example is, I will save your child from the disease they're, you know, suffering from if you'll sleep with me, kind of thing, right? You now are in a worse place than you were before you had that option, arguably. Some will argue, at least. So, you know, are we putting people in a coercive situation or when we offer them that kind of button? And can they understand all of the horrors of mental anxiety that happen when you uplift your IQ past, you know, monkeys in this kind of way, right? Like, you've just created an shape with anxiety.
So there's coerced choice, and there's informed choice.
Right, there's coerced choice, and then there's just understanding the harms.
And so I mean, that latter point is an informed choice issue. Mm-hmm. What struck me with that hypothetical is, I mean, that actually seems considerably less coerced than every other choice that anyone ever makes in the real world. I mean, it's very much, all right, you don't have to go to work, but at that point you won't have money to buy food. We're constantly, you know, if you said rather than press the button for 10 IQ points, they press the button to get $10.
Well, but IQ points are dollars, right? You could say, look, if you get 10 IQ points, you will have, you know, your salary goes up by like $20 on average.
Unless you're taking someone entirely out of a real social framework. We live in a society where every single choice we make is, to a greater or lesser extent, coerced.
Yeah.
Because, or alternatively, it's a meaningless choice. I mean, if you work from home, you just go, well, I'll wear a red shirt or wear a green shirt. It'll make very little difference unless you're a Star Trek character.
Mm, right. But this is the problem with euthanasia, right? There are a lot of liberals who are pro, you know, legalized euthanasia, but in a society where we don't have, you know, reliable access to medical care without bankrupting our family members, having access to consensual euthanasia creates a coercive choice. It creates a situation where people feel pressured to do this thing to take care, you know, to take care of their family. So, you know, your point about, like, in our society, there are no uncoerced choices is exactly my point, right? Like, yeah, but that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the hypothetical about the IQ button seems considerably less coerced than pretty much any other situation you're going to find yourself in life.
Because you feel like you can decline more, or because,
well, you press the button or you don't. I mean, it's not you know, press the button and sleep with me and your IQ will go up 10. There's no you know, there isn't the second sort of clause of the syllogism isn't there.
Well, I think, and this might be missing the point of the hypothetical, but what I'm thinking about in terms of the press the button or don't is the fact that you might be able to spend that time doing something else, right? The idea that I'm going to sit at home for, you know, the rest of the night and keep pressing the button because of whatever benefit it brings me, but that, and I'm doing that instead of hanging out with my friends, or instead of making a podcast, or instead of playing roller derby, or whatever it is, like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can certainly, I think to make it a, you can add that second clause in. Certainly, and at that point, it becomes, you know, it's very much so. You could say, yeah, press this button 5 times, and you will be 50 IQ points smarter. You will never enjoy just sitting and talking nonsense with your friends. Right. In the same way, you will never be able to just watch that sitcom that you really like, because you will just be constantly seeing where the jokes are going before they land. And at that point, that does become a meaningful choice. But at that point, also, it becomes a more informed choice.
Well, so, I mean, the question is, do you have to say all of those things for it to be an informed consent, is my question. And do they have to understand that loss? Can they understand that loss?
Well, and for me, to be clear, it's not even necessarily a matter of, like, being so intensely and horribly aware of things. For me, it's more like I might be sacrificing my ability to, you know, make a whole bunch of money from being smart because I'm spending time with my friends instead, right? Like, making the choice between those things. I feel like in a hypothetical scenario where I had that choice, I would feel bad about doing anything else for the rest of my life, I feel like. Specifically because I would feel like I'm wasting time doing one thing when I could be doing... Like, and you know, you can make that argument in terms of I'm going to hang out with my friends versus taking some course that's going to help me be better at whatever I'm doing.
I've got it. So here is your full-on coerced... choice is press this button and you will become 10% more dedicated to your job. And that's it. And at that point, not only is it I can absolutely imagine all the things I am losing by pressing the button, but your boss is standing over you looking at the button and looking at you and saying, well, what do you say?
Well, this is actually really valuable because this, you know, I promised that we were going to come back to meritocracy and here we are. You know, the education side of this for me is toxic meritocracy is exactly what you're describing. Mm-hmm. Growth mindset approaches in education have been an improvement over the old model, which was, oh, you're smart, you can do the thing, or oh, you're dumb, you can't. Now it's, oh, you can make yourself smarter if you do all these things, or you can make yourself a little better at math if you work on all these things. And what you get are workaholics who just spam that button because our reward system in society is all built around skilling up in this kind of way.
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, we've seen some trial programs recently about things like 4-day weeks and UBI and things like that. And they are, every time someone runs a trial of something like that, it always comes out to, yes, people are massively happier and no less productive when you get them to work less. It's just a net positive on all fronts.
Unless.
But it runs so counter to the way our society has evolved. Mm-hmm. That no one's ever going to do it.
Well, right. And I mean, I can say I have personal experience with that. The last day job that I had when I started, it was 4 10-hour days instead of 5 8-hour days. And even given like the longer time, the 10-hour day, like that didn't feel like as much of an imposition to me as when the company I worked for got bought out and they switched it over to, you know, 5 8-hour days. Like that felt like so much more of an imposition on my life. And so, yeah, that's just like, I have a personal connection to that one. And it is just so like dumbly obvious to me that that's the right way to do things.
But, you know, Adrian's point is that there's a rational incentive to reject some of those things if you worry in education that your child will fall behind as a result. So attempts to remove homework, for example, get major pushback from parents because they want their kid at home spamming that IQ button in that kind of way. Mm-hmm. And so... You know, I think there, like your point that it's all coercive, right? We're always being pulled towards assimilation into that kind of capitalist system in this kind of way makes it very hard not for, you know, if you offer someone any piece of uplifting technology, or even if it's self-uplifting, if it could contribute to that system, it becomes a compulsion in that kind of way.
Which brings me back to the point that I always end up at almost all of the time is that the thing you hate is not the thing, it's capitalism.
That's right. It's not communism, it's capitalism.
Yeah, it becomes a really tricky question. So, you know, if you gave someone the uplift button for their kid, as it were, or the IQ button or whatever, that's problematic.
They'd spam it hard. Difficult. I mean, like early, like look at the stats for early childhood education, right? And then compare that to getting to, you know, press a button really hard over and over again. They would hire people to press that button for them, which is tutors. That's just literally tutors.
I suppose it is.
I do think it's, and this is important to me because the folks I think who are doing culturally relevant pedagogy are aware that meritocracy is a problem, but they don't understand why or to the degree, I think, because they, you know, still are progressives. And so they still have, you know, this is something that I wrestle with as a progressive. It's hard not to slip back into that benevolent, uplifting mindset. You know, as an educator, you are trying to benevolently uplift people all the time in this kind of way. And you're trying to do it in the least coercive way that you can. But there's no fully non-coercive way to teach people things because you can't get informed consent about, you know. So like, you know, I teach about luck all of the time. And it, like, some people go very weird when they learn too much about luck. But there's no way that I can warn them ahead of time what it's going to feel like when they start seeing it everywhere. It just happens.
Well, the thing that I'm thinking about, though, is that part of the reason that conflict exists is because I feel like a lot of the times when we're teaching people things, we're teaching people about surviving in a system that is just not built for the way that we might intuitively operate, right? Like, we're teaching you how to operate inside of a system where, like, most of us have to punch a clock and go to work and do economic output in order to survive, right? Where if education was really about the, like, learning new things and assimilating new experiences and all of that, like, I don't think there would really have to be much coercion involved, right? Because that's a thing that humans most of the time are very, very into instinctually. And it's the fact that we have introduced this, like, I am teaching you how to survive in a system that is just, it is going to cause you to suffer. Because you are not at the top of it. And I have to, like, push you into learning a lot of things that don't make sense to you and aren't going to feel good to you for reasons that early in life you're probably not going to understand but aren't going to feel good, right? Like, I used to think that I hated learning because I hated elementary school. It wasn't learning that I hated, it turns out.
Yeah, it's true. Now, I think the advantage that, like, the dream of something like The Things is you're changing both things at the same time, right? Because you have this problem. You can't change the individual till you change the system. You can't change the system till you change the individual. That's our fundamental catch-22. There's no upstream and downstream problems. There's a giant ocean of problems. But if you're, like, overtaking the physical individuals at the same time that you are, you know, doing this communion process, I guess the idea would sort of be you're changing everything at the same time, fundamentally all the way down. And it's, you know, it's an interesting question that, like, similar to how your language might shape your world to some extent or your way of understanding it, does your biology shape your understanding of your society? Do we end up in these hierarchical systems not because they're actually more effective, but because we just always think, you know, somebody's got to be the brain and somebody's got to be the heart and stuff like that?
Well, I think There are certainly some things. I mean, one of the things we were talking about, you know, our obsession with improving things for our children. That's, I suspect, a big mammal thing, because the parent-child bond is a mammal thing, probably more than it is in most species.
Well, right, you divide your species up by the kind of reproducers, right? You have the ones that reproduce a bunch, and most of them die, and
yeah, and it's a bit of a misnomer because it's one of, you know, parental care has evolved multiple times independently. We see it in a variety of other groups, but it's specifically with mammals and live birth particularly has evolved multiple times. But with mammals, live birth is a given unless you're a monotreme, and therefore, it seems reasonable to assume that that's become a big, you know, our attitude towards our children and our posterity is potentially shaped a bit by biology. But when we're talking about things like hierarchical societies, there's certainly some evidence that when you go back sort of far enough in the anthropological record, you do not see the same kind of hierarchies. It's possibly, by some readings I've read, it's possibly something that turns up when you start to get settled agriculture. When there are more and more complex tasks to do, but also, one of the key things there is when you've got a thing there that is potentially someone can come and take. So if you got a bunch of young men together, they could go and take someone else's stuff, their crops, whatever. They turn up at harvest time, take the crops. They don't have to spend all the time harvesting the crops. The people with the crops say, well, we will have our own young men. They will be our people to defend the crops. And that group of people defending the crops becomes your warrior aristocracy who are in charge and don't actually have to do any of the work very, very quickly. Although, at least this is kind of partly what I've read and partly my own theorizing about where that kind of top-down hierarchy comes from. I think there is a bit of a tilt point. But also, do you know the Indus Valley civilization? One of the things that it's a very old civilization. It is very complex. They have a lot of things that aren't seen but anywhere else in the world for a very long time. What they don't have is big buildings for rich people and small buildings for small people. Their cities are built where everyone kind of has the same amount of space.
So they
do not seem to have that big hierarchical division, or at least as far as we can tell from the way they lay their cities out.
There's a great book. I think it's called The Beginning of Everything, Graeber's book. I could be wrong about that. and I don't, I'm not enough of an anthropologist to like go line by line through it and know what's true and what's not. But one thing that was interesting about it is that it problematizes the traditional account of human cultural history, starting from, you know, small hunter-gatherer bands turning into settled societies that turn into cities that turn into countries, et cetera, et cetera. And pointed out that for a very long time, a lot of societies actually resisted that deliberately, that they had processes by which they would have temporary governance, but not permanent governance, that they would engage in various behaviors like negging people who got, you know, successful hunts so that they could prevent the rise of kings or something like that in this way. I think there's a lot of factors, and it's important whether, you know, like whatever is true or not, it's important to try to understand it, because people will then make arguments down the line that like hierarchy is natural or hierarchy is,
yes,
you know, right, progress or something like that. And they'll show, you know, this was the past, yeah, et cetera.
Yeah, it's Hobbes' Leviathan, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right, well, exactly.
And this, I mean, that comes back to the question of division of labor, right? Because I think hierarchy is not just about the fact that different people do different things. It's that different stages of that process have a different value, right? So, like, I think it makes a lot of sense to say that, like, well, this group of people seems to be good at this thing, so that's going to be their job. And this person seems to be good at this thing, so this is going to be their job. Like, that's a sort of thing that feels like it would develop very naturally over the course of, like, as soon as we have enough cognitive skills and enough social connections that we start building family groups and peer groups and tribes and the different sorts of groupings of humans that we have developed over time, it makes sense that we would develop maybe specialization in that kind of way. What feels very not necessarily inherent to me is the idea that we would ascribe higher and lower value to those things the way that we do, right? Mm-hmm. Like the leader or the person who is the decision maker, I could see very simply being like, okay, we're having a food problem, so this person that knows a lot about food gets to make that decision because that's what their specialty is, versus we have this exalted leader that has this higher social value that gets to do that about everything regardless of what they're actually good at. That feels much more to me like something that would arise naturally than something that we recognize as a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, in the same book, he talks about like these sort of bands of communities would consistently, they find, come together and for a period of time form essentially like a government. They would, you know, like have a king for that period. That person would adjudicate various issues or something, and then they would disband it essentially. So it was kind of like, rather, because they feared this idea of like a permanent government, you know?
Well, right, and that comes back to a difference in values, right? The value in that situation is that we have a problem to solve and this might be the only way we can solve it, versus teaching power as an end and a value unto itself.
The Dawn of Everything, I apologize. The Dawn of Everything, A New Human History by Graeber. You know, again, all of these like big epic scale books, there always are problems. I think Guns, Germs, Scale, all these kind of things, you can always poke a hole or two in them. But I think it's at least valuable for pushing back on classic cultural narratives in this kind of way. I realize we're starting to run short on time. Should we maybe do the thing we always do and then hop over for some After Dark?
Yeah. Time? All right. Yeah. So next episode, we are going to be talking about panpsychism, which is a word that I have never really explored before, which I'm very excited. And because Aaron loves me, we're going to be doing a Star Trek episode. Context is for Kings. Wonderful, wonderful episode of Star Trek Discovery. So I'm very excited about that.
Yep, it's episode 3. And yeah, you know, it's in our continuing series of Make Life Easier on Cali while they learn a bunch of terms by letting them watch Star Trek. So take a break from the darkness for a second and then come back to it. And of course, I have to thank our patrons. I'd like to thank our new patrons. We have a new fungi, Thomas Henderson, and several new red shirts. Thanks to John Butler, Pandemic 21, and Caldwell. And of course, all the thanks to our incredibly strong AI patrons who will benevolently live over and uplift us from our stupid meat brains. Randall Nelson Peterman, Corey Ebert, I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. Big Easy Blasphemy, givetomodestneeds.org, then visit deepfakestop.com. A wise Zen once said, you can't be neutral on a moving train. Jesse Rabinowitz and Brenda Goodman, Alex Arnett, dude, Jesta, and all the thanks to our absolutely definitely not a clone. We just took communion, so now we're all one patrons. Alex Beneshek and Yelling at Podcasters is Para Antisocial. Thank you all so much. And I also want to thank once again our friend, our guest on the show this week, Adrian. Adrian, do you want to let folks know real quick where they can find you in the various social media spaces and take communion and, you know, all the books and whatnot?
Sure, you can get hold of me on adrianchaikovsky.com. I'm at aptshadow on Twitter and Mastodon and probably any other platform I migrate to as these grand structures of ours all collapse around our ears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said, you know, you're very friendly. I highly recommend folks reach out and say that your books are amazing because they are. And I think that's pretty much all the things. So, Callie?
With that, I believe it is time for us to take a trip down to the abandoned cargo bay that no one ever goes into except for this purpose. So those headed down there with us, go ahead and get headed down that way, and we'll see you in a minute.
Thanks again to our listener units and patron units. Your support makes our internet broadcast possible. If you want to hear more from us, check out our other internet broadcasts, Queersplaining and Embrace the Void, as well as our wonderful editor Louisa Lyon's filmed live musicals podcast. Leave them all 5-star ratings and reviews on your podcast application. You can follow us on Twitter at @ZeroGPhilosophy or email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. If you want to support the show and get even more juicy sci-fi hot takes, consider joining the crew over at patreon.com/ZeroG. Just $2 a month gets you early access to episodes and after dark content. Until next time, friends, stay gooey.